In this episode, I'm joined by Corey Anton, who is a Professor of Communication Studies at Grand Valley State University, Vice President of the Institute of General Semantics, and past President of the Media Ecology Association. In this episode, we discuss his latest book, How Non-Being Haunts Being, on possibilities, morality, and death acceptance, alongside discussions on Ernest Becker, the mind-body split, nature, communication, and more. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my paid patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you would like to support Emetics for the very low amount of $2.50 a month and gain access to some exclusive content, then please find links in the description below because it is very much appreciated and keeps the podcast going. Enjoy. Okay, so Corey Anton, thanks very much for joining us on Emetics Podcast.
Thank you for having me, James. It's a treat to be here.
We are going to be discussing your very new book, How Non-Being Haunts Being, on possibilities, morality, and death acceptance, which is a book covering really nothingness to an extent, nihilism, zero, negation, in very interesting ways, which aren't constrained by, as we were just saying, academic forms of doing things. This is quite a refreshing book in that sense. Draws on Becker and people along those lines. I mean, I'm sure we'll obviously get into it. But yeah, just tell us a little bit about yourself and how this book came about.
Well, I guess I would say it's in some sense the final book in a trilogy. Going back to my dissertation, which I wrote in around 98. Or so. It was published in 2001 called Self and Authenticity. And then I did another book around 2010 called Sources of Significance, which really does a lot more on Ernest Becker. And I was, you know, a little bit more involved even in the Ernest Becker Foundation there. And then this was coming off of my most recent sabbatical. It was in winter of 2018. And it tries to wrap up some of these discussions about what is the nature of the self, what's a significant life. And then now, you know, this issue of how non-being haunts being, it's been there all the way along, you know, so I do have a lot of stuff on negation and non-being all the way back to the dissertation. I mean, one of the common, you know, characters who makes various appearances, two of the people who sort of make various appearances are, Douglas Harding, who did all this fascinating work on the headless way, and also Alan Watts, you know, I think has done a lot of very interesting popularizing of Eastern thought and Buddhism and things like that.
Okay. So, I mean, that's interesting. I'm sure we'll draw the trajectory of your thought, because I know it touches on you have an extremely eclectic sort of career in a way. So I'm interested to see who you'd put it, you know, in the room, the Hermetics question. You can place three thinkers, living or dead, into a room.
Yeah, I thought it was fun. You'd ask that question. And I had various people, you know, listed, you know, immediately it would have been something like Heidegger, Sartre, Merleau-Ponty, or it could have been something like, you know, Burke, Bateson, and Goffman, or, you know, it would have been nice to have Wilden. But I think the three, if right now I could have three people listening in on this conversation, it would be Thomas Paine, the historical Jesus, and George Carlin. Those would be the three.
See now, like, I've had so much time to think about this question, obviously, and like, originally I was sort of like, you're like, yeah, I'd love to hear a lineage, like, I don't know, Deleuze, Kant, but then you think, oh man, that's not going to be much fun, really. I've got their books. Like, I like that you've put George Carlin in there.
Yes, we need George here to keep us all, you know, sane.
So, what do you think where do you think that conversation would go?
Well, I think we could start with was Jesus an amazingly enlightened figure? Yeah, I think so. Is this the person who came back from the dead and all this kind of other stuff? No, I think not. And it would be fun to have some laughs about it and some serious discussion with, you know, a person who was, I think, a historical figure of interest. You know, the historical Jesus is sort of interesting. And Thomas Paine's relationship. See, I think a lot of people don't realize that, you know, Paine, if you read his Age of Reason, has just these scathing criticisms of what the Bible has done and the way that Christianity has appropriated the sort of book of nature or the, you know, the only true revelation that there is, you know, the nature and life itself. And then, you know, Thomas Jefferson was so taken back, impressed by some of this. He produced the Thomas Jefferson Bible. Now, he didn't release it during his lifetime because he saw how badly Paine was treated, but he went and got a Bible, King James Bible, and he took a razor and he cut out every instance of a miracle. And you can buy it now. Today, you can go get the Jefferson Bible. You know, it's sort of interesting.
So he was sort of changing, removing anything sort of magically divine. So you end up with this sort of... What was his reasoning for that? So you have sort of a realistic basis to...
Well, I think the founding fathers were very serious about taking the developments of science, the realization that had come with, you know, the mathematical tables that the printing press had produced had made for unbelievable accuracy in astronomical projection, which gave further legitimacy to science. Lots of developments were happening. And I think that people... They wanted to give something like a moral authority to Jesus and to the tradition that had come in the wake of that, but they wanted to disentangle it from all of the ridiculousness, the sort of the claims to supernatural, the claims to intervention, the idea that God plays favorites and all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Are you a religious man?
I would say, the book is trying to defend a robust form of spirituality, I guess, detangled from religious dogma. I think, you know, like here would be a way to come at some of this, James, right? So there's all these priests and bishops and deacons, and this is where we need George Carlin, right, from Dogma or something like that, you know, sort of making fun of these, like all these hierarchy of these men's club, and it's God the Father and God the Son, there's no God the Mother and all this kind of stuff. And you wonder, how can all these people still be employed? I mean, how do any of these people still have jobs? Well, there's some sense in which there's lots of good that people do, and there's, you know, community service to the needy and the poor and the sick and dying. But there's also this fact, which is there's a fireball in the sky, animals are running around eating each other, and none of us have a clue where this came from. And so there's this profound mystery, but there's no money to be made in the mystery. Instead of just going, wow, there's a mystery, let's just sit and bask in it, let's accept the way that non-being haunts being, that is, that we're caught with the mystery of being yet not knowing how we are, what we are, or even where we came from or what our ultimate destination is. Instead of that, we go, well, here's what it is, and here's how you play favorites. And it becomes politicized, and it becomes this huge, like, industrial complex of a game of, you know, orchestrating power and stuff.
Okay. I mean, I noticed that in your book, you take in a good way, in a productive way, you sort of, people make that joke about how, in contemporary philosophy, contemporary thought, people will write, you know, a 500-page book rigorously defending with every citation imaginable the smallest position ever, and then even then they'll say, but we still don't really know. But then you go back to like the classics and you have people going, here's what I think, here's the answer to the cosmos, have at it, I don't care. And it seems you're sort of, I'm not saying you were doing that, but you're some in between where it's like, you know, let's go back to these broad strokes, let's try tackle these big questions again without feeling the need to constantly reaffirm things via, you know, in that sort of hierarchical sense you're on about with the deacons, you know, that sort of constant footnote and citation. Let's just dig in. You know, and that's why I think as well, I quite like the Alan Watts side, you know, Alan Watts being included.
Yeah. I don't want to in any way appear like I'm waffling. I think anyone reads the book, they can see that I very much espouse the view that I think that when you're dead, you're dead. There is no life after death. But I also want to express the view that I'm not trying to be dogmatic. I'm not claiming that I know with certainty and all this kind of stuff. I think that's my sense, you know, from all the evidence that I have and, you know, how my metaphysics, the whole thing, how it all works together. It's okay that, you know, people die. But I don't think that means that life is meaningless or that nihilism is the only response to the fact of our finitude. That comes from this presumptuous arrogance and the way that people have become filled with a kind of ingratitude. I mean, I did a lot of this in my 2010 book where I was talking about the causa sui project. This is Becker's term for the way humans have become a kind of cause of themselves and in history. And, you know, in the Burke lends a lot in the 2010 book as well, where he's giving a critique of what he calls roughly authoritative disambiguation, that the world has lots and lots of ambiguities, and we want to be on the lookout for people who are trying to authoritatively disambiguate it. And so we can recognize, you know, that we don't want to rid the world of ambiguity. We want to be able to identify the places where it necessarily arises.
Okay. Okay. But that, this whole thing for you, you're sort of a, I don't want to say a neo-Beckerian, right? The whole thing for you begins from that Becker trajectory, which was accepted for a brief amount of time, and then people pushed it away. No one wanted to go back to thinking about death again. Even psychologists didn't want to go back to accepting Becker and think about death. So that position, say, look, death is the meaning behind the majority of things. The reasoning for doing various things is death, and death, as it's seen somewhat in your book, is non-being, right? The potential, at least, for we're comfortable now because we sort of understand what being is. We've got sensibility, we're living, it's pretty great, maybe, unless you're Schopenhauer. But, you know, non-being, well, that's the great worry, right? Because what's that? But this is the huge question, right, which I'm going to just give straight to you. How can non-being be, right? What is that? What is non-being?
Yeah. Okay. So non-being is parasitical upon being. It's the complement to being. It's not being's opposite. It tags along and tarries on the backside, and it allows things to be what they are for humans who exist. That is, humans, if you got to employ like tweezers-like language in this Heideggerian sense of the difference between kinds of being, there's extants, things, objects, you know, rocks and scissors and tables. And then there are animals that live, and, you know, life is their characteristic of being. Humans exist, and by existence, we're able to entertain a vast world of what was and what will be and what should be, what might be, what could be. And so to the extent that the world that is includes the world that was and that will be, it has to include the world that is not. That is, the was is as it no longer is. You know, I mean, when we say that something is not yet, we're talking about its being in terms of its not yet being. And that is its status as being. Its being is not yet.
Okay. Do you think that the non-being actually then in a Heideggerian way comes before the being, right? That's our reasoning developing being?
That's right. In order to think the being of beings, you have to think the nothing of things. That is, you have to think of things in terms of their possibilities in order for the things to show themselves as what they are. That's exactly right. I think this is where we get, like, you know, for Heidegger, I think some people see it like as an anthropology, but no, he's trying to get at the historical development of being, the clearing of history. Like, say I take something like Julius Caesar. If I say Julius Caesar is a historical figure, he was a ruler of ancient Rome, what might he do if he were to have the chance to live today? So, I mean, the world of humanity is a world of thought, and it includes grammatical moods of conditionals, of possibilities, again, of you know, even the indicative, you know, it has to delimit, it has to specify, and any delimitation is already to haunt a being with non-being. That is, what its boundaries are, where it's located in terms of where it's not.
That's a pretty, you know, from someone who doesn't believe in the afterlife, who's not, you know, that's a pretty optimistic standpoint, like a productively creative, almost Nietzschean standpoint of what nothingness can be, right? I mean, the end of Becker's project seems to be that he didn't really know what to do with this thing he'd realized. He retreats into religion himself and says that there's meaning there. Perhaps you could correct me on whether or not Becker found something. But, you know, that idea of it being not, you know, not yet, that seems extremely optimistic. Is that how you see it?
Oh, I do. I mean, I could see someone reading, you know, my work as an Easterner going, this is basically a Western Buddhism. This is a Western scientific Buddhism. This was sort of person is trying to get something like life affirmation amidst impermanence. And the impermanence is the fact. And when we talk about impermanence being the ultimate reality, it's to talk about how non-being haunts being. So, I mean, I do think I tried to really avoid it, you know, introducing Eastern thought into the book, partly because it's just such a huge can of worms. I mean, in the East, nothing and non-being are like staples in the way that, you know, the equivalent of something like, you know, substance or predicate here. But I think the Becker thing, I guess I would say this really quickly, and I did a lot of this in the 2010 book, you know, it's that the mature trilogy, if you take Becker's The Birth and Death of Meaning, second edition of The Birth and Death of Meaning, and then you take Denial of Death and Escape from Evil, he goes from self-esteem to death denial, then ultimately to what he starts calling guilt expiation and the Causa Sui project. My own sense is that he was soured because of his utter optimism when he had discovered self-esteem as a mediating principle. I think he thought he had the solution to self and society. And then the more he thought about self-esteem, he started to realize it had no limits on the needs for self-worth, and that symbolic self-value can become so expansive that it starts to be very tyrannical. And then by the time you get to Escape from Evil, admittedly, his wife did a lot of the touch-ups on that. It was published against his will after his death and whatnot. But I think he finally hits upon something other than just death denial, which is the guilt of being ambiguous and being... See, he defines guilt not as you've done something wrong. He says the ability to perceive a totality yet unable to move in relationship to that totality. So it's his way of sort of saying that people, whether they're free or not, experience something like agency. And so they're never sure if they're overestimating or underestimating their obligations to the world. And that ambiguity, I think, really it led him on a very different path. If he would have begun, my argument would be that if he would have began at that spot and then went on to death denial, he would have been in a much better position with his project. It's because he went from self-esteem to death denial and he finally discovered the guilt expiative function of a lot of those death denying rituals that were being done in the ancient world. I mean, it was sort of like he read Norman O'Brown's Life Against Death and Otto Rank's Art and Artist, and it just blew his mind, and he had to redo a lot of his stuff, you know.
But you link the sort of the development of nihilism with self-esteem, right? With one's self-esteem.
I would. I would say, you know, you had a question, something along that. Yeah, I think, I would say the mediating factor is something like relevance, that historically people were tyrannized by tradition, but relevance was sort of guaranteed because your fit was in the cosmos of things, whether for good or ill, you were relevant because sort of fit into the social schema. Today, people are besieged by a kind of, what do you call it? Social, cultural, historical diaspora of the individual trying to make their way about their own lives. And they can feel utterly irrelevant. And so then they try to build the world rather than them fitting into the world that's there. They try to make the world fit around the self that they've tried to tailor. And it just creates all kinds of conditions for despair and nihilism because it's an inappropriate ground.
Okay. So in that nihilism of nothing matters, we don't matter, life is meaningless, they are sort of implicating that there should be a meaning, that they're deserving one in the cosmos, right?
That's right. They're smuggling in the back door. And again, it's very ambiguous. You have to sort of chase it down because there's a sense in which, yeah, the animals are in the same fate, but they seem not to suffer the despair.
They're just living.
They're just living. And because you asked the question before, I mean, non-being is utterly unthinkable. You can't think of your own non-being. It's just so unthinkable. And I think for, you know, the best we can do is like we can try to imagine things like dreamless sleep or if we've been anesthetized or, you know, there are senses in which, you know, we have friends die or, you know, we see people disappear and then we kind of, you know, analogically go, yeah, I guess it'll happen to me. But it's you can't think the thought of not being, you know, you can't, there's just, you're always caught with a something. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a non-being. I think it's very real.
Yeah, that's interesting going back to your, you know, people would say that you're like a westernized Buddhism, because that makes me think, you know, you put this emphasis on non-being, which you've brought in at the start, say like no, nor, or the past, or the future, not yet, could be, all these potentials, whether they're negative or positive, these are all non-being. And that seems actually in that Buddhist point of view that being is the present, right? That's the thing we've got. Here's your being, it's here. Whereas time in any other direction is non-being. And the Buddhist thing is don't focus on the now, focus on the present, right?
That's right. So again, this would be where you dovetail in. I say, you know, if I say to people, is time real? I think they go, yeah, it is. I say, is thought real? I think they're going to go, yeah, thought is real. If I say, is non-being real? They go, no, there's no such thing as non-being. Well, you can't have time or thought without non-being. Thought is a kind of time that inherently deals with non-being. And the point would be that the Buddhist has learned that thought is largely dealing with possibilities, and it learns to not attach to those possibilities, to accept the impermanence of whatever's coming. But I don't think that the Buddhist wants to say that everything is just nothing but now. They're going to say the now is an ongoing impermanence, meaning that there's a non-being haunting the being. And so the task is to become not attached to the kind of fictional fantasy hot air that we're continuously producing. And I think when somebody wants to know what I mean by non-being, the simplest, most robust, most continuous is just thought. You know, I was preparing for this and I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, you know, well, what will James ask? And will he say this? Is he going to go right through it? And I prepared for a lot of things that are never going to happen. Mm. I mean, at one point I was going, I had to go get a sandwich, and I'm like, you know, what if something happens in the car and then I miss the interview? Now that never happened, but somehow I can think about what didn't happen. And that is part of my world. The problem is that in the West, people have become very attached to the non-being. And if we say, well, no, the insight of Eastern thought is to not attach to that. Well, not attach to what? That is, you have to learn how to discipline yourself out of attaching to the non-being that continuously keeps presencing up in the flow.
I mean, that's an interesting conversation right there, though. I mean, on the Western side, you definitely have this obsession, right? We're somewhat obsessed with the past. We always bring it into the future in that Heideggerian way once again, but we're really obsessed with the future. And that seems to be in this non-being sense that we're in a state of almost, ontological anxiety, right? We need to know where being's coming. We need the anchor. We need the thing. We need to know. But then when it comes, well, it's already gone. So we need the next thing. So, but that's this question of detachment, I think is interesting, because do you think that's a problem of communication then, in the sense of an actual detachment is, you know, the idea of detachment is that there's something that you can detach from, but this can't be the case with non-being. So really we need to detach from the idea that we could even communicate with the thing. It's like, it's just not for you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this goes back to the whole Heraclitean thing of, can you step into the same river twice? Well, who does? There's all this kind of stuff, right? It starts to become really complicated. I guess, How would you get at that? When I was young, I think I had this sort of like purist thought that in order for the change all around us to be noticeable, there had to be something that was unchanging to register it. So again, I sort of thought, okay, if everything's change, then there has to be something that's unchanging, or the change would be imperceptible. And then as I got older, I realized, no, it's just too purist. That doesn't really work. All you need is differing rates of change intersecting, and it produces the illusion, as it were, of objects, of things that have something like a permanence. So I don't need a buttress of like a real self who is not attaching. The body is a network of different spatio-temporal horizons that overlap and intersect and loop back upon each other. And it's this, you know, to use Hofstadter's term, it's a kind of strange looping of the body in its relationship. And Bateson, you know, the body then looping in strange ways with its environment and a kind of cybernetic system. Right. I mean, this is sort of where I think you get, you know, notions that like Wilden, you know, I mean, I think Wilden was really good at recognizing a kind of ecological self that isn't reducible to this kind of Lockean, I don't know, this atomistic fragment, this self-sustaining isolated individual or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, that would fit my favorite Wilden quote, which is life, what is it? Reality is what trips you up when you're not looking. Right. And if you're looking, there's non-being coming in somewhere else, which you're not gonna have any draw on. It's not for you. I mean, we've gone real deep into the philosophical side of things. There's an interesting question that I want to bring in on the sort of the social side. You know, I think maybe you can feel free to disagree with me. I think in the West we it seems increasingly more common to admit, you know, we feel a bit lost, we feel a bit empty. And I think you could put this down to, you know, we no longer really have, as you were on about earlier, we no longer really have the traditions that we used to have. We no longer have the church and, you know, since Nietzsche, the death of God, we no longer really have that direct connection to our nation. All these forms of social being, which we, you know, real anchors, they're gone. And it seems this emptiness feeling that everyone has is no longer really a panic about what's going to be. It's now like all these things are gone, and it's like the revealing, like, oh yeah, that thing you didn't want to admit to, that was there all along. So we're like, we're in a social state where we're just constantly dealing with, like, we've admitted to it now. Like, yeah, the void's there, the non-being's there. Now what do we do? Where do we go? Where do we go from here, Corey?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I guess I would say that we'd have to make a distinction between those absences in the world that we can recognize. So mm-hmm. I lost my job, I lose my religion, I no longer can follow my traditions, my culture. I look and I see I don't have any money in my wallet. I go out and I look and my car's not in the garage, or the pickle jar is out of pickles. There's all these different ways in which absences and like disconnects, and there are the experience, I mean, like the empirical experience of a gap or a lack or something that's not there. I'd want to differentiate that from that gap that I can be aware of, which is awareness itself. That is, awareness is a kind of removing a self, effacing an absence, a transparency, an emptiness. And it's in the same way that we've gotten rid of organized, you know, dogma, or we've gotten rid of, you know, certain, I guess, nationalistic tendencies, this kind of stuff. I think it's time to start to ask, can we get rid of the notion of the self as an atomistic separate entity? See, I think a lot of this has to do with the history of literacy, that I think many people, because they have experienced literacy from age, you know, from very young age, and we've grown up in a society that has widespread literacy, we sort of get bamboozled into thinking individuals form society. But we don't realize that there were, you know, thousands of years worth of detribalization that has occurred through various communication technologies, literacy being the prime one. And so money and literacy are these radical detribalizers. For Becker, right, these are the two legs that the causa sui walk on. It's money and literacy. They fund the functional, autonomous individual in society. Without money, without literacy, we're really caught in tribal kinds of connections and relations. And so I think that, again, this the emptiness that I'm after is trying to recover the ultimate emptiness that we really are at our core, that self who can think, who can feel, who can sense the world. And at a certain point, we become, in this sort of like Sartrean way, we become nothing other than the world that's disclosed by way of us. And it's a glorious, glorious event when it happens, when you finally discover who you are, when you discover that you're not the sack of skin that other people can see. You're not just this little physical object that we could set on a scale and weigh. No, you're the way the world worlds. That is, the world needs processes of releasement and appropriation to give itself spatial and temporal delimitations. And we are like space-time modulators. We're the world worlding. You know, it's like Watts would say this way, you know, you didn't come into the world, you've come out of it, just as a tree flowers, the earth peoples, right? And as the earth peoples people world. Like, again, people come out of the earth and then worlds comes out of people.
Mm-hmm. And in that, we're sort of like almost like a negation function where we're just revolving and whatever is. But I don't want to go on that sort of Freudian level where we're like filling a lack. There's some other function in relation to negation. Why do some get filled and others don't, I guess? Why do some futures get filled and others don't, I guess, would be the question in the relation to that human worlding.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you hit it earlier that you had already mentioned that there's a kind of narcissism that once I come to fall into like the ego stuff, this is, you know, you had it at the end too. Once I have the Lacanian sense of self that's estranged, where again, I'm a sack of skin, rather than the opening of the world that's still in something like an oceanic connection and undivided unity. As soon as I fall out of that and I think I'm over here and the world's over there, there's no way to repair the damage. Once I come to realize that the only way the world can be there is by my headlessness, the only way that the world can have a face is for me to not see my face, you know, like the most important absences are the absences that make awareness possible. That is, it's not just I look and I see and my car's not there. It's that I look and I see, and the one thing I never see is my seeing itself. That is, seeing, the act of seeing, has to disappear for the sake of what is seen, what appears in the visual field.
And what would change?
I'm an ongoing clearing. We're all the clearing that is the world worlding.
And how would the process of worlding change if we could sort of remember our seeing while we're seeing? Awareness, I guess that would be.
Yeah, I mean, I think what happens is there's a kind of estrangement that goes on in acculturation where I give up being the world and accept. I sort of trade that in for a socially agreed upon social identity and a sense of self over here. I say that I'm Corey and I'm this and I'm that. And I have this occupation and this, I live here and this identity, instead of realizing again, the sort of openness and capacity to for world that we really are fundamentally. You know, like a different way to say it would be this, you know, I do this a lot in the book, but that, you know, some of our greatest, most fundamental riches can't be personal possessions. They're the way the world makes purchases on itself through us. So like the sunset, you know, does the sun ever really set? No, I mean, from a physics and or, you know, biological set, the earth is just rotating, the astral bodies are rotating. And it, depending on where you are, you know, if you stand and you face west at a certain point, you can see the sun setting. But in some way, the sun is always setting and rising 24 hours a day, every day. That's all it does, is rising and setting. But because we can be positioned somewhere with our body, have a forward, face the west, the sun can set. And that means you are the sunset. There's not some sunset. You're not representing it. I think we imagine that, again, we're sack of skin and the sun's setting and then I'm just over here representing it. No. There wouldn't be a thing there to represent without a body located at a certain distance, having a forward, facing west. There's all these other dynamics that do like work that causes that thing to come into being. That is what we call a sunset.
And
it's not there independent.
And this is your a naturalist fallacy, right? This complete lopsided separation. And this is sort of... Yes. This is where you sort of begin in the book, really, this fallacy. So hopefully you can sort of go into it. But it is this lopsided behavior where you cause this complete separation. You're no longer of that worldly process that you mentioned.
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, I would say that, you know, I'm greatly indebted to Anthony Weldon for all the stuff on what, you know, I took it, what I would say from him on his work on the difference between information and communication theory and the notion that you want to see dependent hierarchies where other people see oppositions. So if you say like mind and body, a lot of people, they go mind and body, those are opposites. Whereas William be like, no, one is the environment for the other. There's a dependent hierarchy there. And the same thing with, if I say nature and humans, it's not as if, and this goes all the way back to the Greek tradition, the separation between culture and nature. I mean, the culture and nature split is sort of fundamental to Western culture. And I'm really trying to critique it like all the way down. Because I think, you know, if we say that humans are not natural, or that art doesn't occur in nature, or music doesn't occur in nature, we kind of miss the fact that we are that part of nature that arts, that calculates, that makes music. And what we do is we're understanding less than the whole of nature while we treat ourselves as other than natural. That's the basic anaturalist fallacy. The basic way to explain the anaturalist fallacy is when you draw a line between humans and the world, or humans and reality, you're always going to comprehend less than the whole of reality because you treated humans as separate. And then you end up treating humans as if they're not part of reality or not part of nature. And we are.
And that's the exact same thing that's happening with people who are nihilists, right? Who have a nihilism. They're saying, oh, something else should be happening for me. There should have been some meaning, and you just take yourself out of the whole thing. So what is, are you finding an answer then for nihilism in then that you're saying almost it can't really exist unless you would admit to that fallacy?
Unless you'd succumb to believing that there really is a separate self and a kind of ego that could be spared, there is no, like, who's nihilist? I don't know. It's like a trap that someone falls into from having an expectation of meaning or something like that. Yeah.
See, that's the interesting question. Meaning. What happens to meaning once you don't, you know, once you don't succumb to that fallacy? If you're not succumbed, is being itself simply the meaning? Or there isn't really such a thing as meaning because you're no longer this privileged, separate.
No, I think there's still meaning. We have natural horizons of meaning. And, you know, in the previous book, Sources of Significance, right, the 2010 book, I tried to lay out three different horizons, one in our work, one in our relations with others, and one in our kind of spiritual identification with the cosmos. So, I mean, I think there are different places where we can find genuine significance. It just doesn't have to be the overdrawn expectations that came with religious dogma. I think if you discover that there's no life after death, but you never were promised one to begin with, it's not such a letdown. It's the big promise of it that I think really forces it into, well, that sucks. But if instead you go, I'm just grateful for having been, I'm totally grateful.
Mm-hmm. So you're sort of turning, this is the thing that I found funny. You obviously got the Leibniz philosophy of life in that vitalist sense. You're almost turning that on its head. You're taking that Becker position and turning that fear into, you know, utilizing that idea of that fallacy in the Wilden's hierarchical sense where everything has its own sort of position. And you're sort of turning that fear of death onto its head and saying, yeah, but it's death, but not as you see it. You're only seeing it that way because you've separated yourself. Just be grateful for the whole process. Which is a Watts position as well.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's a sense in which there is no death for the dead. That is, death is something the living have to deal with. We're never going to deal with ourselves when we're dead. So it's sort of like, there is no death. I mean, life only knows itself from the inside. You know, here's the thing I want to get in. You know, I just wanted to say this is that there's this Joe Rogan fellow, right? He talks all the time about psychedelic drugs and this kind of stuff. And how I saw him, I'm trying to think of who he was, Brian Greene, maybe. And he was talking about, you know, he's done so much DMT that, you know, he wants to know what goes on when the lights go out, you know, and he's been to the house and all this kind of stuff. And I kept thinking, you know, I don't know where people get the idea that somehow a psychedelic drug gives them access to something like, what's life after death? Now, and here would be my response to it. Like, I'm not suggesting that there aren't profound things to be learned through psychedelics and that some of this could be very valuable. Ego death. Anybody who has a psychedelic experience where they rapidly undergo ego death and they realize that their whole life had been a kind of, you know, a certain house of cards that were built up in a particular organism, that can be very profound in dispelling death fear. None of that gives life after death evidence. And the argument that I would want to give is something like this, is that now we have these amazing scientific technologies that allow for ancestry.com and DNA testing and all this kind of stuff. And if we can go in, I can spit in a jar and they can send me back all kinds of detailed, you know, information about my history and ancestry and, you know, what percentage I'm Neanderthal and what percentage I'm this, that, and the other thing, I wouldn't then find it surprising in any way that there are, that we don't understand yet, forms of memory loads stored in the genetic sequence that people are somehow accessing. Like, there's a kind of ancient memory load somehow, like we're millions of years old. Like, I feels like I'm just in my 50s because I remember my birth and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But really, I've hijacked a body that has already evolved and had, you know, millions and billions of years of evolutionary survival value built into it. So how do they know, these people who are claiming that the machine elves have told them that they're going to go to the afterlife, how do they know that they're just not accessing kind of ancient processes that have been continuing on for millions or billions of years?
I mean, yeah, DMT is just going into another type of being, right? It's not non-being.
It's a dream.
That would be great if people took DMT and just went into non-being and nothing happened.
It's a non-being. It's a dream that's awake. And see, I think the thing about non-being is you got to get at the problem of representation. So like a dream is something, but because a dream is about something, it's inherently infected with non-being because what it's about is actually not there. And that's true of language. It's true of all symbols and all signs. All symbols and signs, they work by absence. Otherwise, it would be a thing.
And we'd all be able to communicate with each other exactly in like the perfect Wittgensteinian way. Like we say it and it's exact, which is not, it's never going to happen. So there is sort of a problem of communication here in that absence is the thing which makes communication both possible, but also infinitely difficult.
Completely agreed. And I would say, you know, the two lines there, one, you know, George Bernard Shaw, he says, if you have an apple and I have an apple, we exchange apples, we both still have an apple. But if I have an idea and you have an idea and we exchange ideas, now we both have two ideas. So there's a sense in which, yeah, information isn't like a thing. It's not just a being. It's already haunted with non-being. And this is why Goffman says of all of the things of the world, information is the hardest to guard because it can be stolen without removing it. Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. It makes it, you know, like if I give you the pen and you take the pen from me, I can see that you took the pen. And so the transmission is clear. You have it. I no longer have it. I was successfully giving it to you. But if I'm trying to convey an idea to someone, I don't know if they've really received what I've given because they never take it from me. I still have it too.
Okay. I mean, jumping back to this life and death, because I think death's a big cornerstone here.
Sure.
I think a big mistake I think could be made in saying that a lot of people make them synonymous, life with being, death with non-being. Whereas in that discussion we've just been having about ideas, death just seems to be a socio-cultural idea, one of mimetic, right? If you're brought up and saying, you know, by the way, fire and brimstone, unless you do this, this, and this, you're going to be terrified of death. But if you're brought up in some other cultures where, I don't know, ancient Mayan cultures go, oh, every Saturday we do a sacrifice. And by the way, that's great. And I think of the cultural distance between so many different civilizations, I mean, people who grew up in the war, their idea of what death is going to be. So, I mean, death's this just fluxing piece of information that we shouldn't conflate with non-being, right?
Oh, exactly. That's exactly right. That death isn't the reign of non-being. Death is the loss of all non-being. When you're dead, you're now completely what you are, at least for yourself. Now, others can still complete you because you remain an incomplete project in their incompleteness. But yeah, going back to your example, you know, yeah, Mayans, the Aztecs in particular, you know, the Aztecs had these games where they would throw the stone in this little, like a basketball kind of court with the stone. And if you were the winning team's captain, you would get beheaded. You're like worthy of sacrifice, you know, or like the original Greek games, you know, the original Greek games, they wrestled in the nude and you were either knocked unconscious or knocked dead. And if you were knocked dead, you were immediately declared the winner. Because death is so unthinkable, so unfathomable, so much what the living never experience, it like literally doesn't exist for people early in like some way. It's just, you know, it's more like we in developing and solidifying these abstract notions of ego and of thinking of ourselves as a sack of skin that represents the world and its only relation is representation. I think it's easy for us to fall into this. It's a sort of narcissistic fear and lack of gratitude and you know, other kinds of basic malaise that make life itself like a conditional. And this is, you know, the beef I have with a lot of religion, particularly the Christian faith, is that when I was doing the 2010 book, I asked so many Christians of different faiths, different subsects and whatnot, if suddenly they learned there were no life after death, could they forgive God? You know, would they be fine with that? Or would they just give up their faith and say, it just doesn't make any sense at all? And I had so many people say to me point blank, I mean, just look at me. I mean, almost had tears streaming and said, this world is filled with so much suffering, so much hardship, so much luck of the draw and injustice. And just, it's a horrifying shit show. Unless there is life after death, none of this is justified. No, this is an absolute horror show. To which my sense was like, oh, so let me get this straight. The only way that this life is in any way justified is if there's something other than it. Oh, that's a lack of gratitude, something fierce. Like it's a people who have just completely lost touch with who they really are. We're animals. morals.
Yeah, I mean, that's also the nihilist thing again, right? The separation. You know, the idea of justified. Justified to which, you know, which authority?
Yeah.
You know, who's making this? You know, I don't want to go into the whole like, we're just beings on a rock, you know, floating around, because I think that equally is a bit sort of needlessly morbid. Oh. But I mean, there's, you mentioned gratitude a lot, and I sort of respect it, because the tendency for a lot of modern secular philosophy is to go towards the sort of almost antinatalist position, or these positions of sort of almost where humans, you just, the animals removed, and we become these just fluxing, I don't know, you can't even describe them. But yeah, it seems there's almost an answer to the antinatalist argument in your work, in the sense that, once again, they're making a problem of life and being, in the sense of where suffering actually is and what suffering actually is. I mean, yeah. I struggle to sort of formulate this question, but do you see in your theories of non-being and being, do you see almost a way towards understanding what, you know, why there's suffering in the world?
Well, I mean, I
or what
really
suffering
do.
Is
I,
in the world.
I value David Benatar's, you know, how not his book, Better Never to Have Been. I think there's a lot to be said of giving voice to the antinatalist, particularly as he is espoused by Benatar. You know, he's very like hard line. It's not morally justified. There's an asymmetry of imposition of life on someone who did not ask for it. And again, it's an interesting argument, but he's also very hardline about, you know, this would never be something that you could impose without being more tyrannical than, you know, it's also immoral to try to impose that upon people, to tell them that they can't do it, to like enforce it. I think I like antinatalism as a foil to the radical pro-lifer. You know, I think the pro-life position really needs that antinatalist corrective in order to bring things into like a proper relief. But I guess I would say, yeah, I don't want to underplay the amount of suffering. I mean, I think it is very real that life is a horrible place. It's an absolutely, you know, it's ghastly when you historically, especially, and the degree to which just senseless brutality, and it's not just like the luck of the draw and the suffering and the plagues and all the natural hardships, but just the stupid like brutalities and like grotesque stupidities that people inflict upon each other, like needlessly, that's really quite horrifying. And, you know, I think that my own sense would be it's ambiguous. That's all that's true, but it's also absolutely miraculous and wonderful and stupefying. And I guess from my own perspective, and this is the hard line where I would get maybe really against the antinatalist position, which is that I don't think, and this is, again, the narcissistic arrogance comes in again, I don't think the world needs human justification in order to be justified. This whole notion like, oh, well, unless we can justify it, it's not justified. Says who? Nature needs us to justify it. It's just bizarre. I mean, they're kind of like, who do people think they are?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was going to say when you say, oh, like, life's awful. And it's like, well, that sounds like you had an expectation. And like, who's, you know, it's not like you signed up for something. So I guess the antinatalist thing comes in there. But at the same time, you know, saying, oh, this life's so awful, it's full of suffering. Well, but nature doesn't really recognize what you understand to be suffering. That's to some degree conditioned.
Right. Right. And I think, James, again, you're hitting it just beautifully there, because if non-being didn't haunt being, you'd never be able to experience what's not the case. Mm-hmm. You'd just be in the whatever is going on. But because we can have expectations, we can taste the difference between what's there and what we thought it should be. Mm-hmm. That is what's not there.
So without non-being, it's pure horror, because then
no horror.
Well, no, I guess there isn't.
There's no meaning.
From the third point of view, from the third position, if you could see these animals with no non-being, that would be horrifying, because it'd just be autonomous.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, in a strict, like, if I'm going to do more like the tweezery strict language that I'm trying to do in the book, I mean, all life is characterized by incompleteness and absence, that all life has metabolism, they have nutrient gradients, heat gradients, there are various things where they're managing relation states, trying to avoid certain states, bring about other states. Even if it's like withdrawal or refusal, there's nascent forms of non-being, even in like, you know, plankton and, like, you know, very, very simple forms of organisms, arguably bacteria. But by the time you get to humans with their extensive nervous systems, sensory capacities, social historical communication technologies, we're the most robust sites of nature that have incompleteness and non-being, which means that we can ask ultimate questions like, where did all this come from? What happened to start the universe, and what happened before it started? You know, we can ask these, again, these sort of like impossible questions.
Yeah, man. I think, I feel we've touched on so much so quickly. We've gone deep and managed to draw everything in. I mean, is there something about in the book that you feel I've missed?
I guess, I don't know what I would say. I think the thing would be something along the lines of, you know, when people say, could you forgive God? Well, when I say to people, could you forgive God? And I only say it to Christians. I'm looking for a Christian who's really devout. And I say, could you forgive God if suddenly you discovered as fact, like in a Copernicus way, like we discovered as fact, there is no life after death. Could you forgive God? And when people look, it's very common. The Christian says something like this, what? They'll go, no, forgive God. You don't forgive God. God forgives you. You know, God's all good, all loving, and all knowing. If anything, you're the sinner, and you need to have God forgive you for all you've done. And I think, you know, that's what they're saying, but it's not really what they're believing. Deep down, they go, there is a guilty God. God is partly responsible for the situation. That's why he sent his son, Jesus. And when they grab their heart and they go, I accept Jesus, what they're really going is, I accept the apology. Life sucks. You gave a bunch of raw deal to everyone. But because you're going to make amends later, I can now accept life. And I just think, wow, it's really, you're holding yourself hostage to a fantasy, unable to have gratitude for all that you've been given because you want more than that. You know, and I think part of the difficulty, and this goes back to the why we're not just animals. No, we're not just animals. We are, as Becker would say, we're angels with anuses. We have one foot, you know, foot, it's planted deeply in animality. Another foot is planted in symbolicity and transcendence. We are noble yet humble creatures. We're very humble. We're going to die, but we're noble. We're able to ask about how we relate to other people. We're able to ask how we relate to the cosmos. We're able to contribute in a generational way. We're able to create art. We're able to just cry for the sorrows of humanity. It's fascinating to really think about what it means to be human. It's miraculous to really take a moment and go, like, there is good news. Have you heard the good news? You're alive. It took billions of years for this to happen, but you're alive. You're experiencing the miracle. Celebrate it.
I mean, I can't top that. I can't top that. And I think you've expressed it perfectly. I mean, it's so simple, which is the Alan Watts position, right? It's like, you know, what's the meaning of life? To experience life. To experience. Why have you overcomplicated everything?
Yeah.
Just to have this brief duration.
Joseph Campbell has that great line. He says, people don't want to know the meaning of life. They want to feel the experience of being alive. Yeah.
That's right. Cool, man. That's good. So, I mean, I wouldn't want to add more on that about your book, but you said before we started recording, you said you're sort of done now, potentially done now with writing.
Well, I have some smaller projects right now. I mean, it was my seventh book. It's my third monograph, and I have a collection of essays I'm working on, and I may do another book. I may do something on AI. I'm not sure. I've been doing, you know, some preliminary stuff on it. I feel sort of like the lemon where all the juice has been squeezed out. I'm all squeezed, you know, and it really, I did. I was so exhausted writing the book. I mean, it really just took it out of me. It was so exhausting and fatiguing to write it. You know, it's whenever I bring up the stone example, everybody goes, oh, Sisyphus. No, it's not the Sisyphus stuff. I mean, but it's like, you know, it's this huge rock. It was a huge rock. And some days you just spend the whole day or half the day trying to find the right place to grab hold of that rock. And finally, like, oh my God, I have the place to grab it. And you roll it forward. You're like, yeah, I got it forward. Then the next day you're like, oh, but I lost my grip now. You're trying to find a good grip and you can't get a good grip. And so you got to push it back to where it was in order to get a better grip. So, you know, some days you roll it forward a couple of feet. Other days you're just spending the time trying to get it repositioned for a better grip the next day. I was very grateful to get it done. Yeah, I'm happy to have it out. You know, it's expensive, so it's hard to promote. It's really hard. I tell anybody who's listening to this, if you're in any way interested in anything that's been talked about, get your local library to get it. You know, get it in your library. You know, if you can't afford getting it, I think at the very least, get it in your library and other people can share it. There is a reading group that's meeting right now that is doing the book. They're doing it like chapter by chapter. This Sunday night, they're doing chapter two. People want to get in on that. They're just like every other week, they're doing a chapter.
Huh. Okay.
It's a former student who's a professor at Arizona, Jermaine Martinez, has put all this together. Really grateful, very, very helpful, you know, happy to be involved and, you know, thankful that he was able to put that together.
Yeah, sounds great. Sounds great. I'm sure I can get the links and put them in the description for people. Yeah. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, James, I just, you know, thank you very much for having me on. It's a treat always to get to talk, you know, about one's work. And I am really excited about it. I do believe in the project. I don't think I'm trying to found a religion or anything crazy, but I do think there are horizons of meaning and gratitude and I guess acceptance that come from like the maturity of, again, I'm not saying I know that when you're dead, you're dead. But if that's all there is, I still have gratitude for this life. I really do. I'm humbled to have been invited to the banquet of all banquets.
That's a beautiful place to finish. Okay. Corey Anton, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, James.